To see everybody out tonight. We kind of talked last week. We were going to kind of change things up a little bit on Sunday nights and kind of go over with Vacation Bible School being the mystery of Christ. Kind of on Sunday nights that I speak, talk about the life of Christ and not try to do it in a way that's going to bump up too much against Rick's Sunday morning class. But just sort of touch on the life of Christ, and we sort of talked last week, we weren't going to necessarily do it verse by verse or chapter by chapter or book by book. We're going to try to kind of meld it all together in some sort of chronological type study. Going to use the PowerPoint on some Sunday nights. Some Sunday nights we won't. This is going to be one of them, maybe much to Kathy's chagrin. Not going to be sometimes heavy on verses. We will talk about some verses, but like I said, it's just going to be more of a study on the life of Christ. And so this week we'll talk a little bit about that Roman census. Now, we know that here every 10 years we do a census, a decennial census, and that started way back in 1790, and we've done it every decade since then. We've had about eight, and from that information, we find out how many of us live in this country. We learn about demographic characteristics of our population, our age, our educational levels, our race, ethnicity, are we male, female, income levels, poverty levels. So we know all this. In addition, that information that they get from the census is an important factor on how money is distributed, on how the federal government distributes its money that makes its way to the states and municipalities for various programs that we have in place. But a very important reason why we have the census and why there's a constitutional basis for having the census is really to determine how the House of Representatives are distributed, how those seats are. There's 435 seats in our House of Representatives, and it's based upon the results of the census. And that's a process that's known as the, somebody say it for me here, the reappropriationment, right? That might happen sometimes if a state's population decreases too much. They might lose a seat, and a state that's gained those people, they may gain that seat that the other state lost. Every congressional district at some point in time right now represents about 700,000 people if you take them one at a person. And so following the 2010 census, the state below us, Texas, they gained two seats back in 2010. And that's happened to some others. Other places lost some seats. California lost a seat. Michigan lost a seat. Ohio, West Virginia. Now, I guess the point I'm trying to make is all of this census, it impacts Americans, but for the most part, it doesn't really interrupt our day, right? Every decade or so, we might have to open our door to a stranger and answer some questions from them, or we might get something in the mail that we mail back. Maybe now it's just a click on your mouse, right? And you hit send, and you can send that information for the census back. But that was not the case for a Roman census. When a Roman census occurred, it wasn't just click on your mouse and go about your everyday life. When the Roman government declared that there was going to be a census, people that were interested in knowing how many people that they were, there was that. But what they were really interested in is the tax base, right? How much money can we get from this people? And so the census worker or the census official would ask people some questions, and then based on the answers to those questions, they would establish how much tax that person owed or that household owed. And it would be nice to think if your Roman census workers were all above the board, but that's not really the case. There was a lot of manipulation of the information, and historians tell us that was the case, that citizen or that census officials, they often badgered citizens to agree to certain things that might not have really been true. And so in order to collect more tax from them, for instance, a father or mother or a husband and wife might show up with their two kids and maybe an older parent. And the elderly individual would be exempt from tax, and the children would be exempt from tax. But the census worker, they might start asking questions to that father. And maybe the father said his son was 10 years old, and the census worker would look at that kid and say, I think that kid's about 12. And so you would owe taxes on that kid. He might look at that man's elderly mother and he'd say, well, how old is he? And she'd say, well, she's 65, and that would make her exempt from tax. But that census worker may say, looks more like 55 to me, and thereby would make her also a taxable entity, as well as the same thing could happen to however many donkeys you might have or however many sheep you might have. You were sort of at the mercy of that census worker. And so it was an unpleasant experience to be part of a Roman census, I think particularly if you were part of an occupied area. And so Caesar would announce that a census was going to take place. And again, this isn't voluntary. You had to participate whether you liked it or not. And it was another reminder that your people weren't in charge, right? It was another reminder that you bent your knee to the will of Rome. Luke is the only gospel that mentions the census. In Luke chapter 2, verses 1 through 3, and it's important detail because I think it explains why a couple, Joseph and Mary, would travel all the way to Nazareth from Bethlehem. And it says, in those days, a decree went out from Caesar Augustus that all the world should be registered, that this was the first registration when Quirinius, the governor of Syria, and all went to be registered, each to his hometown. And so Kathy's going to put this map up there. Joseph traced the roots of his family back to David. And so he had to participate in the census back in Bethlehem in spite of the cost that would be involved. Not only the cost of the trip, but whatever the cost in terms of taxes once they got there in front of the census official. Certainly, the inconvenience of the trip and the discomfort, particularly no doubt for Mary, who is with child, all of these things add up, but Joseph and Mary make the trip, and basically it's because they don't have any option. And if you look way up in the north, you'll see Nazareth there, and way down towards the south there, you see Bethany. Nazareth to Bethany is about 80 miles, but it's not an easy trip. In that time period, it would have taken about 4 days for Joseph and Mary and whatever group they were traveling with to get down there. And that's what historians tell us, that with Mary being late in her pregnancy, it may have even taken more than 4 days to get them down there. Now, by contrast, from here to downtown Tulsa is about 73 miles. And we can do that pretty quick. We could do that several times in one day if we wanted to. So that kind of gives us a sense of how far it is from Nazareth to Bethlehem. You would have those basic landmarks there, the Sea of Galilee there, and if you move down, we'd see that the Jordan River empties there into the Dead Sea to the sort of there to the right. You can kind of see that. That may not be the best map, but each of these places are provinces in Judea. Judea was a large province that had a large population, and it had a large amount of land that was included in Judea. Places like Bethany and Jerusalem and Bethlehem, of course, Samaria, and we'll talk about Samaria a lot as we move forward. And then, like I said, Galilee and Nazareth there in the northern part, and these areas are going to come back several times as we talk about the life of Jesus. And so as we see those, we kind of some geographic areas that don't really come up on a map, but there's going to be some mountains there in the northwest area that they're going to have to try to handle getting over, and they call those the rolling hills of Samaria, but they're a little bit more than rolling hills. And then as you continue to move down south into Samaria, you're going to come to what they call the Central Mountains. And again, these aren't the Rocky Mountains like we would see in Colorado. These are about the lines of 3,000 feet above sea level at their highest point. So more think like more the Appalachian Mountains more than you would the Rocky Mountains. And after you would get through those mountains, you would come to the Jordan River Valley. And the land drops off noticeably. In many cases, it's below sea level. And as we kind of continue that trip, moving east there towards Bethlehem, those hills begin to give way to desert. And so Joseph and Mary are traveling from Nazareth to Bethlehem, and it's going to be not an easy trip. That their route would have went through those central mountains. And so contrary sometimes to maybe what we think would have been the case of them traveling just alone, just the two of them, it's quite likely that they were part of a caravan, a large group, probably for their own safety. And we'll talk a little bit about that route that they're taking. It is also the same route that Jesus would use when he gives the parable of the Good Samaritan. So it was a dangerous route as well that they are taking. So traveling in groups would have been for their safety. Bethlehem is about 5 miles south of Jerusalem. So they would keep on going. Once they would reach the large city of Jerusalem, they still had a little ways to go. Scholars tell us that Bethlehem is a very small village, that maybe a couple of dozen families lived there at the time, extended families at that, not just nuclear families, but several extended families, but still a very small area that wouldn't have had room for a whole lot of people showing up that was extra. And in our vernacular, we might say Bethlehem was a wide spot in the road, right? So what was going to happen here in Bethlehem was they were going to be overrun with census workers and people that are coming to be counted, the descendants of David that were going to have to come back to Bethlehem because the census was happening, and that's going to cause a housing crisis, and that Joseph quickly learned that was the case. And sort of as we talked in Luke 10, there Jesus tells a parable that we call the Good Samaritan. And we know there that man's traveling down the road from Jerusalem to Jericho, and he's attacked by robbers, and he's left for dead. And as the story goes, a priest walks by, and he doesn't help the man. A Levite walks by, and he doesn't help the man. But a Samaritan individual, he walks by, and he stops and helps the man. And he bandages his wounds, he puts him on his donkey, and he takes him to an inn. And he leaves money there with the innkeeper along with instructions to care for this man. And he says, I'll be back at some point in the future. And if you bear any expense beyond what I've paid you, I'll reimburse you for that too when I come back. And the significance, I think, of that story, or why I want to tell that story, is in Luke 10:35, Luke uses the word innkeeper there. Now, if we look back into Luke 2 at the birth of Jesus, in Luke chapter 2, verse 7, in the English Standard Version, it says that she gave birth to her firstborn son and wrapped him in swaddling clothes and laid him in a manger because there was no place for them in the inn. And now that's the English Standard Version. The American Standard King James Version also used that word inn. The Message uses hostel. The NIV uses the word or the expression guest room. The New Living Translation, it uses the most generic of words. It just simply says lodging. It's not really completely clear what kind of lodging was available, but scholars point out that Luke knew the Greek word for innkeeper because he uses that specific word in chapter 10, but he doesn't use that specific word in chapter 2. And so it sort of gives the idea that Joseph and Mary arrive in Bethlehem, and Joseph starts searching for a room. At the inn, that's probably not really how it happened, at least in the way that our modern thinking thinks of an inn. to sort of further that idea maybe of an unscrupulous innkeeper who tricked Joseph into paying money for space in the barn where he and Mary would sleep with animals, I don't know where that idea came from. That may not be accurate either. And again, keep in mind, Bethlehem's a small village. A couple of dozen extended families lived there. Scholars tell us that in all likelihood, these were poor people. These were peasants. They weren't wealthy in this small village of Bethlehem, and it certainly didn't have a Holiday Inn like we think of it. And so Joseph was simply looking for a place for he and Mary to sleep. And it's quite likely that he was going door to door to homeowners and asking if they had space in their homes. So how many homes did he have to go to before he had space? Well, we don't know that. But eventually, one homeowner offered them space with the animals. And from that, we get the idea that maybe Jesus was born in a barn or in an outbuilding or in a shed or a lean-to or something along those lines. That's probably not the case. If you look at this next picture, this is an artist rendition of a Jewish home from the first century. And you can kind of see how that's laid out. Kind of take that upper room off and just focus on that lower room. That's where most of your families are going to live. And you've got a second spot there for your animals. Now, that top part is important because when Jesus will go in during the triumphal entry and he'll tell the apostles to go find a man and he'll have a room, a lot of times if you were rich enough, you had a guest room. You had an upper room. And we'll know that upper room again when Jesus has that last meal with his apostles would take place up there. Typically, everything is going to happen down low, and your animals are going to stay indoors, just in another section of the place. They again, if you had a little bit more money, you might add that upper room. Now, if he couldn't find a spare room, he would have settled for, in all likelihood, where you see that goat behind that gate. That would have been literally better than nothing. So here, people are staying in the space. Over there to the left and to the right, you got the animals, and that was probably the best that Joseph could find. Now, it's sort of unlike that image we have of a wooden sort of cradle-looking thing that was about shin high, that would have been a middle floor. This next picture is a rendition of what a first century Judean manger looked like. And that's not made out of wood. That's something that's made out of stones. It's sort of a feeding trough that animals could stick their head in and get into that area and eat. And the manger would have been built on the floor. And if it wasn't built on the floor, it would have been built into the side of the house, into one of the walls. And so when Jesus was wrapped in swaddling clothes and placed in the manger, it wasn't probably a little wooden trough thing. It was probably a stone manger that sat on the floor. Maybe shin high, perhaps knee high. That would have been something that, again, made out of stone that would have been used for Joseph. So Joseph was able to find a space for he and Mary, but it was with the animals. And if we get into the actual birth of Jesus and the events surrounding that, we're all familiar with our nativity scenes that people put out during Christmas. Maybe you've even seen a live nativity scene where people, actual people, are dressed up as Joseph and Mary and the shepherds and all of that, and they have a little wooden manger out there and some sheep, and then they're doing their best to depict that time and arrival of the baby Jesus. And if you haven't seen one of those, no doubt you've seen a plastic one that somebody has in their yard. Perhaps, you know, you have a nativity scene above the mantel place in your fireplace or coffee table around Christmas time. We've all seen that. But we want to try to piece together the events, the actual arrival of Jesus. And in doing so, you might find that our image of the nativity scene really looks like something that's been culturally embellished. So if we really want to get to the story of Jesus' birth, we won't find any details in the Gospel of Mark, and we won't find any details really in the Gospel of John. They go directly to Jesus' adult life. So the details come from Matthew chapter 2 and from Luke chapter 2. But you sort of have to merge them, right, and to get them to go together. Some assembly is required if we want to get all those details in place. If we want the angels and the shepherds, as the angels came and told the shepherds that the baby was born, that's going to be in Luke chapter 2, verses 8 through 20. If we want to get to the part about the wise men, or what some people call the Magi, we'd have to go to Matthew chapter 2, verses 1 and 2. And we know that wise men came. The Bible doesn't tell us how many wise men showed up, but we know that there are three gifts. And so somebody did the easy math at some point and said three gifts. There must be three wise men, right? They brought gold, frankincense, and myrrh. So when those nativity scenes are assembled, oftentimes that's what they use, three men to bring three gifts. But biblically, that detail does not exist. What we do know from Matthew chapter 2 and in verse 8 is that King Herod was the king of Judea, and he instructed the wise men to report back to him once they had found the baby Jesus, because according to verse 8 of Matthew chapter 2, Herod told him, he said, I want to worship the baby too. But God had already told the wise men through a dream to not do that. Don't go back. Don't go back to King Herod. You need to go back a different way to your home. And when Herod realized that he had been duped, that these wise men didn't come back and tell him where Jesus was, he became enraged and ballistic. And I think, next week we'll have our fellowship day, but following that, we'll sort of pick back up right there. And again, on the Sunday nights that I speak, that's sort of what we'll do. And again, I don't want to bump up against what Rick's doing on Sunday morning, but just in preparation of VBS for the Mystery of Christ, we'll just kind of go over some lessons on the life of Christ. And so tonight, if anyone's here not a Christian and you're ready to put on Christ through baptism, the baptismal waters are ready. If there's anyone here that would like to make a need known to be addressed by the congregation publicly, now would be an opportune time to come as together we stand and we sing.